a new reality for the U.S. and UN.
Our tax dollars should not be complicit in propping up entities that are counter to American interest, anti-Semitic, or engaging in fraud, corruption, or terrorism.
The U.S. has a new Secretary of State.
Without peace, it is hard to be a strong nation, a prosperous nation, and one that is better off.
And will TikTok be saved?
I could see making a deal where the U.S. gets 50% of TikTok.
Today is Thursday, January 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. It's been a busy few days in Washington. President Donald Trump took office on Monday and already has signed well over 100 executive orders. The orders seek to reverse what he sees as mistakes made by previous administrations, as well as reorient foreign policy.
Following its withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization earlier this week, the United States is also expected to reduce funding to UN agencies that do not align with the Trump administration's America First policy. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
Lean times are ahead for the United Nations as the United States withdraws from international commitments, including its membership in the World Health Organization. WHO spokesperson Tarek Jasarevic.
It was 18% of the budget in 2023. And as I said, the U.S. is the largest single donor.
On Monday, his first day in office, President Donald Trump signed various executive orders, including one to exit the U.S. from the U.N.'s Paris Agreement, an international climate accord.
The United States will not sabotage our own industries while China pollutes. With impunity.
The U.S. is the world's biggest producer of fossil fuels that cause global warming. It's also the largest financial contributor to the U.N. In her Senate confirmation hearing Tuesday, Trump's nominee for U.N. Ambassador Elise Stefanik said that the children's agency UNICEF and the World Food Program are effective U.N. agencies. However, funding for others will be cut, including for UNRWA, the agency that helps Palestinian refugees.
Our tax dollars should not be complicit in propping up entities that are counter to American interest, anti-Semitic, or engaging in fraud, corruption, or terrorism.
When Trump reduced funding for many UN agencies in 2017 during his first term, European Union countries stepped up financially. But now they're focused on defense spending to help Ukraine push back against Russia's invasion, in part because of Trump's skepticism toward aid for Kyiv, French President Emmanuel Macron.
Now that the new administration in the United States has taken office, it is more important than ever for Europeans, for our two countries, France and Germany, to play their full part in consolidating a united, strong and sovereign Europe.
Meanwhile, China is unlikely to expand its UN funding, said Richard Gowan, UN director of the International Crisis Group, via Skype.
Chinese officials are also realistic that their country is facing some economic headwinds, and they don't have lots of spare money to throw around. So I'm afraid that there is no obvious alternative funder for the UN to turn to.
This is the second time Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 Paris Agreement that aims to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels by slashing planet warming carbon emissions. Trump's successor in 2021, President Joe Biden, had the U.S. rejoin the Paris Agreement on his first day in office. Analysts said shifting U.S. positions may make other countries take their climate commitments less seriously. Sheila Olmsted, Cornell University professor who studies the economic dimensions of environmental policies, via Skype.
We have less emissions reduction in China or less emissions reduction, right, in other countries of the world. Those countries, right, failing to reduce emissions as a part, right, reflecting on the U.S. example, will create damages that will affect the U.S. economy. Right, the damages are global.
Climate activists protested Trump's decision. Once the withdrawal takes effect next year, the U.S. joins Iran, Libya, and Yemen as the only U.N. countries not part of the climate agreement. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
A new president also means a new Secretary of State, and in his first day on the job, America's new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, met with his staff and spelled out his foreign policy priorities.
He also met with allies from the Indo-Pacific region who seek to counter Chinese military and economic ambitions, VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports.
On his first day as U.S. Secretary of State, former Republican Senator Marco Rubio told his new employees that their department will promote peace around the world.
Without peace, it is hard to be a strong nation, a prosperous nation, and one that is better off.
But avoiding conflict will be a strategic decision.
Never at the expense of our national security, never at the expense of our national interest, and never at the expense of our core values as a nation and as a people.
Rubio also met Tuesday with the foreign ministers of India, Australia, and Japan. The four countries formed the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad, a bloc that aims to counter China's economic and military ambitions in the Indo-Pacific region. Tuesday's gathering eased some concerns about the America First approach under President Donald Trump. Yun Sun, director of the China program at the Stimson Center via Zoom.
It's a clear signal that U.S. is not abandoning the regional coalition, allies and partners in terms of how to counter China's rise.
Beijing denounces the Quad as a Cold War construct, notes analyst Yun Sun.
Anytime that the U.S. aligns with its allies and partners, the Chinese will feel isolated and feel threatened and they will accuse the United States of the Cold War mentality.
The analyst pointed out that China's modernization and expansion of its military and nuclear arsenal will only continue driving countries in that region to strengthen their own militaries and seek a closer alignment with the United States. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Following the signing of the recent hostage deal between Israel and Hamas, President Trump was quick to claim credit for getting the deal done even before he was sworn in. And we heard on this show before how both Israelis and Palestinians were grateful to Trump for his influence.
Now that Trump is sworn in and Rubio is the Secretary of State, how is U.S. policy in the Middle East going to change?
Brian Kachulis is a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Middle East Institute.
The uncertainty and big question marks of what Trump may or may not do in terms of exercise leverage on the two parties to the conflict, Israel and Hamas. Trump did, I think, one very positive thing is he instructed his team, including Mike Waltz and Steve Witkoff, the Middle East envoy, to work closely with the Biden team, who basically constructed the deal. And I think the sense of a change is coming and the fact that he pragmatically cooperated with the Biden team, I think, was one key element of this. I think the real challenge will be when things move from phase one, the first 42 days, to phase two, and whether Trump and his team will be as deeply engaged on the diplomacy.
Joe Biden said when he announced the deal that he created the deal, but it would be up to his successor, Donald Trump, to make it happen. So what I hear you saying is that you're not 100% sure Donald Trump and his team will be all that invested in it, that it might not be their top priority?
Yeah, it's a little too soon to tell. But if you look at the first couple of days of the Trump administration, the executive orders that Trump signed, there's very little on the Middle East. His center of gravity and focus is obviously on the home front. It's more on the issues of immigration and some of the changes he wants to make in the federal government. But in terms of rolling up the sleeves and getting to phase two of this deal between Israel and Hamas, it's going to be really tough because Hamas will have a much higher price for the hostages that are from the Israeli military. And Trump, in comments in the Oval Office when he was signing some of the executive orders on Monday, essentially said, well, look, this is not our war. It's their war. Hope it works out. You know, it wasn't a strong, full-throated sign of commitment to seeing this deal through.
You also said that Trump would like to see a normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And that's something that they were close to before October 7th. Do you see that coming back?
It's not likely as long as the current Israeli government and the Trump team do not prioritize a credible pathway to a two-state solution. And I say that because when I go to the Middle East and talk to key actors, including Saudi officials, it's clear to me that something like what happened with the 2020 Abraham Accords between Israel, UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, that's not in the cards right now, especially after October 7th. And it's not in the cards in part because Saudi Arabia and those that don't have deals with Israel see extreme risk and cost to moving in that direction without there being a pathway to a Palestinian state. So, you know, it's not impossible, but it looks rather unlikely at this stage unless, again, Trump and his team invest a lot more time and attention than I think they're poised to do.
Another new player in all this is Marco Rubio, the new Secretary of State. What's he bringing to the table?
I think what he's bringing to the Trump cabinet is what Trump prizes most in his second term, which is loyalty and fealty to whatever Donald Trump decides to do on a particular day. And Trump was looking for a cadre of yes men. And yes, he's mostly got all men in those positions. And Marco Rubio, I think, it's too early to see what sort of role he'll play. The fact that Trump appointed not just one envoy, but several senior positions to deal with the Middle East. He also announced Mike Huckabee as the ambassador to Israel. All of this is a sign that perhaps the Secretary of State Rubio will not have much sway on these issues. But you could say that for the whole Trump team. This is essentially not a team of rivals, but a team of implementers who will, the number one job qualification is to be loyal to Donald Trump. And from my perspective, I don't think there's any clear Trump 2.0 agenda for the Middle East. It really could be all over the range of possibilities.
Brian Katsoulis is a senior fellow for foreign policy at the Middle East Institute. Mr. Katsoulis, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis this afternoon.
Thanks for having me on the program.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Wednesday that Israel will remain in control of the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt throughout the first phase of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas. European Union monitors will supervise the crossing, with Israeli troops surrounding the area and Israel in charge of approving the passage of people and goods through the crossing. Separately, the UN says over 800 aid trucks entered Gaza on Wednesday.
Haiti's capital could become overrun by criminal gangs if the international community does not step up aid to a UN-backed security mission to the Caribbean nation, United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres said on Wednesday. The force on the ground in Haiti, led by Kenya, needs more money, more equipment, and more personnel, Guterres said. Any further delays, he said, risk the catastrophic collapse of Haiti's security institutions and could allow gangs to overrun the entire metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince.
On Wednesday, President Trump emphatically told Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the war against Ukraine, or the United States would soon impose new high-level taxes, tariffs, and sanctions on Russian exports to the West. 2 days into his second term in the White House, Trump told Putin in a social media post that he was not looking to hurt Russia and that the U.S. must never forget that Russia helped the U.S. win World War II, but that it was time to end Moscow's nearly three-year invasion of neighboring Ukraine. All that being said, Trump continued, quote, I'm going to do to Russia, whose economy is failing, and President Putin a very big favor. Settle now and stop this ridiculous war. It's only going to get worse, end quote. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Prosecutors in Wisconsin have charged a 19-year-old man with felony arson. He allegedly told police he tried to burn down a congressman's office because he was upset over the federal TikTok ban. He was also charged with making terrorist threats, attempted burglary, and property damage. According to the criminal complaint, police discovered a fire at U.S. Representative Glenn Grothman's office early Sunday morning and found the suspect standing nearby and watching the building burn. That's when he allegedly told the officer that he set the fire because Grothman voted for the TikTok ban last April.
In his first term, Trump supported banning TikTok in the U.S. Now, He's given the app's Chinese parent, ByteDance, 75 days to strike a deal with a U.S. buyer. Matt Dibble reports.
Yes, sir. Among President Donald Trump's first acts after being sworn in Monday was signing an executive order giving social media app TikTok's Chinese owner a 75-day extension to find a U.S. buyer or be banned in the country.
Well, I guess I have a warm spot for TikTok that I didn't have originally, but you know, I went on TikTok and I won young people up by 36%.
The move was the latest reversal of fortune for the platform's Beijing-based owner, ByteDance, and its estimated 170 million American users. The site briefly went dark over the weekend after the U.S. Supreme Court upheld legislation requiring that TikTok's U.S. affiliate become a U.S. company or be banned in the country due to national security concerns. But that changed after Trump began signaling support for an extension. TikTok CEO Xiao Chu, who was a guest at Trump's inauguration, thanked him in a video post on Friday.
We are grateful and pleased to have the support of a president who truly understands our platform, one who has used TikTok to express his own thoughts and perspectives.
But some legal experts say Trump's extension may not protect companies like Oracle that continues to host TikTok because the law enacted by Congress still stands. Alan Rosenstein is a professor at University of Minnesota Law School. He spoke to VOA over Zoom.
It's quite possible, and I suspect that Oracle shareholders and some enterprising securities lawyers are thinking about this right now, it's quite possible that in the last 48 hours, Oracle has exposed itself to potentially hundreds of billions of dollars in liability, and there's nothing Trump can do to extinguish that liability.
Trump's action marked a sharp contrast to his first term in office.
We may be banning TikTok.
During which he sought to prohibit TikTok over allegations that the service could share U.S. user data with the Chinese government. In response to reporters' questions on Monday, Trump proposed a new solution, half ownership by the U.S. government.
But I could see making a deal where the U.S. gets 50% of TikTok, polices it a little bit or a lot. Depends on them.
Though Congress originally gave TikTok 270 days to find a U.S. buyer, there has been no public indication of a sale in the works. Adam Kovacevic is CEO of the Chamber of Progress, a tech industry association. He spoke to VOA over Zoom.
The fact that they have not allowed this, I think, is a sign that the Chinese government has real national security interests in maintaining the app as it is, which should really concern us and really underlines the original impetus for Congress to pass this bill in the first place.
TikTok's clock has been reset for another 75 days. But despite Trump's support, the company's future is still very much in question. Matt Dibble, VOA News.
Misinformation is a problem the world over, with Meta and X removing fact-checkers from their platforms and partisans or scammers growing more sophisticated with the content they create. It's sometimes becoming hard to tell what's real.
From security to politics, this spread of false information is a constant threat in Burkina Faso. Gildas Da has the story from the capital, Ouagadougou.
A show of unity between Burkina Faso's foreign affairs minister and Chinese ambassador in October. A fabricated story had falsely claimed the two countries had broken relations. Minister Karamoko Jean-Marie Traoré called the story diplomatic sabotage. On social media and in WhatsApp groups, false information is a constant threat. Jordan Meda is the editorial director at the local fact-checking platform FasoCheck. He says there are two types. Misinformation is shared without the intention to cause harm.
On the other hand, there is what we call disinformation, which is the creation and spread of false content with the clear intent to deceive a community or individual and cause harm to a person, cause, or institution.
At L'Observateur Palga, one of the leading daily newspapers in Burkina Faso, journalist Hugues Sama says his group is taking the problem seriously.
Even a trained eye can be fooled. So what L'Observateur does is provide context on every piece of information we receive. We must also verify it.
When military leader Ibrahim Traoré disappeared from public view for a few days in June, speculation and fabricated videos were rife on social media. skilled fact-checkers were able to set the record straight. But these incidents are damaging, say experts.
For a citizen to be well-informed, they must have access to balanced and accurate information. When they are overwhelmed by fake news, they don't have all the necessary information to have an enlightened view of national life. This is a problem.
MEDA says world powers are vying for influence across the Sahel and promoting their own narratives. But he says they are not alone.
Internally, you also have groups of people who, convinced of their beliefs, spread false narratives. They broadcast them and people believe them.
Analysts caution that ongoing conflict in Burkina Faso is intensifying the spread of false information. MEDA says that advancements in technology are likely to amplify the reach and impact of misinformation, making their efforts even more essential.
That's Gildas Da reporting for VOA from Ouagadougou.
And finally today, we go to South Asia.
India recently inducted three new warships into its navy as it steps up efforts to counter China's growing footprint in the Indian Ocean.
Analysts say while New Delhi was long focused on its disputed Himalayan borders, China's huge naval force has become a security concern, prompting India to increase its own naval power. Anjana Pasricha has a report from New Delhi.
A stealth frigate, an attack submarine, and a missile destroyer inducted recently into India's naval fleet are among dozens of warships that the country plans to add over the next decade. Alok Bansal is director at Independent Research Center, India Foundation in New Delhi.
About 40 warships are likely to be commissioned over the next few years. And that's a significant jump. Even qualitatively, the ships that Indian Navy is commissioning are very high-tech and high-end.
Indian Defence Minister Rajnath Singh said strengthening the Navy was a top priority as the region is increasingly part of an international power rivalry. Analysts say New Delhi is building its naval prowess amid concerns that infrastructure projects that China has built in India's neighbourhood are bringing the rival Asian nation closer to its shores in the Indian Ocean. Rahul Bedi is a defense analyst.
The Chinese Navy has very good relations with Myanmar. It has access to a port in Sri Lanka called Hambantota, which gives it docking facilities. And it has very close links with the Gwadar port in Pakistan on the Arabian Sea. So all around, India is, in a sense, encircled by China. And it is concentrating on trying to break or at least counter this stranglehold by expanding its navy.
The challenge is not easy. China's navy is the world's largest by number of ships. Bedi again.
The Chinese have expanded their navy exponentially and continue to do so. They, in fact, have at least four and a half times the number of underwater and surface combatants than the Indian Navy does. And that's a great source of worry for the Indian Navy.
India's focus for years has been on building its army because of the country's decades-long border disputes with China and Pakistan in the Himalayas. But with 90% of India's trade, including vital energy supplies, passing daily through the Indian Ocean, this waterway has become a priority for the country's political and military leaders. Bansal again.
India's sustenance is completely dependent on Indian Ocean. So Indian Ocean is absolutely important. And for that, India needs to have the freedom of navigation. Our ships should be able to transit through the Indian Ocean freely without being hindered by any power that could be inimical to India's interests.
India's naval expansion is also driven by its ambitions to be counted as a global power. Inaugurating the ships, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said the country will support a secure and prosperous Indo-Pacific region.
India is today recognized globally, especially in the global south, as a reliable and responsible partner.
To boost maritime security, India is also enhancing collaboration with other navies. This month, it took part in an exercise with France and a nine-nation exercise led by France between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.